I have a very dramatic announcement. So anyone with a weak heart should leave now.
Unreal. Revolution. Revolution. Uncensored. Revolution. Revolution. Unfiltered. Revolution. Revolution. Unchanged. Revolution. Revolution. Unadulterated. Revolution. Revolution. Unbelievable. CliffCentral.com. Revolution. Revolution. Revolution.
A very, very hearty and warm welcome to all our listeners on the special broadcast, Looking Up with Professor David Block. What a singular joy, what a singular honor to be with you today. So excited to see all my followers tweeting and using all the social media at their disposal to scratch the unknowable, to dream, to reach for the almost unattainable, to study astronomy, to look at the marvels of entrepreneurship in every single show. It's just so different and so unique with such awesome guests that I could barely wait for the next crossing. For the next 5 weeks, allow me to tell you that I will be in Sydney. Based in Sydney and Canberra in Australia. And so Gareth Cliff will be interviewing me in his morning show, and there will be other guests taking my chair, as it were, for 5 weeks while I'm away. But can't wait, really, to get back to work with Palisa, to work with our audio engineer, Duncan, and to work with this incredible team here at Cliff Central. Do remember, if you want to reach me this afternoon, you are welcome to dial in on 0861-555-189. So to reach me on radio, to reach me live in the global stream, 0861-555-189. You can reach us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, WeChat ID. Twitter handle is at cliffcentral.com. Instagram is at cliffcentral. Facebook, likewise, cliffcentral. And the WeChat ID is also Cliff Central. Just to repeat, you're listening to Professor David Block. My personal webpage is davidblock.co.za. Follow me there. And also please join the tweet feed, which is the handle at Starry Galaxy Man. So that's at Starry Galaxy Man. Today we're going to, our theme is perhaps a little mouthful for most listeners, but we're going to make it digestible. So you and I, as we walk, possess a certain amount of knowledge. And one of the interesting themes over the decades and centuries is, how do we know that we know? And the theory of knowledge falls under a very, very broad category of epistemology. So if you go to Google and you're a little bit frightened by this word, just type in epistemology, E-P-I-S, and then tomology. And you'll see what it really entails. I have a great friend in Australia who's a professor there, and he's a professor in the field of epistemology, and it's a really exciting field to be in. It's one of the cutting-edge fields, really. How do we actually know A, B, C, D, and how do we know the truth? And is truth absolute or is truth relative? So in studio today, joining me live in studio today at cliffcentral.com in Rivonia is Thorsten Merbach. Thorsten, a hearty welcome to you. We are thrilled to have you with us.
And I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you, David.
So Thorsten is going to be one of my honored guests this afternoon. And we'll be tossing all these ideas around of knowing and honesty and choosing. And, how do we actually live our lives in such a way that we're in touch not with virtual reality, but with actual reality? I suppose that's another way of phrasing this whole epistemology issue. And then we have a very special guest from Switzerland, and we are interviewing him live too on air, but the live is via landline, and a very hearty welcome to our special guest in Switzerland, Ellis Potter. Ellis, welcome to Looking Up with David Block.
Thank you very much, David. It's lovely to be with you over the line.
It's just so awesome to hear your voice. I would like to tell all our listeners that Ellis really ranks as an extremely deep thinker. Only last night was I alluding to one of the great works of Auguste Rodin, The Thinker. And it's something, thinking really is so rare in our very modern virtual world that you and I live in. And Ellis is an extremely deep thinker. Ellis, of course, you live in Switzerland, and you've for many years worked at a little place which my wife Liz has told me about, some wonderful stories about the place called Le Brie. Could you please tell all our listeners, Ellis, as to what the aims of Le Brie really were and are?
Yes, thank you, David. I would love to do that. Le Brie means the shelter in French.
Yes.
And it was an organization and a series of communities that were founded in 1955
yes.
by Dr. Francis Schaeffer from America.
Yes.
The first one was in Switzerland, but now there are about eight of them in various countries all over the world. Le Brie means the shelter, and that's really what the Le Brie communities are. They are places where people can come
yes.
and in a sheltered environment and community ask the honest questions that they need to ask and to receive loving, welcoming hospitality that will support them and comfort them in the struggle that it is
yes.
to ask honest questions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you know, this is so interesting because my wife, Liz, and this is going back to the 1970s, my beloved wife, Liz, was visiting Le Brie. We did not know one another at that stage. Of course, she comes from a Jewish background. And she went to Le Brie because she just had so many questions which she couldn't find answers to. And what's very interesting is when we got married, she told me about Le Brie, and she told me about an incredible genius by name Ellis Potter who answered all her questions. So do you actually, would you have sat down with her in a sheltered environment to do this one-on-one, Ellis?
I probably had at least one one-on-one, but I also would have had some mealtime conversations with her.
I see.
Because a lot of the teaching at Le Brie happens at mealtimes where there is one conversation
yes.
and everybody can speak, but only one at a time.
Yes.
So I would have been with her in that situation and possibly in a lecture situation.
I see. Now, Ellis, I'd really love you. Of course, I know, you know, we've known each other for many years via I follow your newsletters pretty diligently. But I'd like you to just paint for all our listeners in South Africa and across the world. Give us an idea of your background, your training, your history, your passions, your interests, and so forth. In other words, a little condensed 5-minute Ellis Potter hook scenario.
Thank you, David. I was born in California and lived there until I was 27.
Okay.
I began as a teenager to ask a lot of questions about what is truth, absolute questions that children ask, like how far is far, how
yes.
high is up,
yes.
how small is small.
Yes.
I wanted to think things down to the bottom and out to the edges of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And there weren't a lot of people who were quite interested in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But I did discover that the Zen Buddhists were regularly interested in this kind of thinking.
Mm.
So I became a Zen Buddhist monk.
I see,
and
an actual Zen Buddhist monk. That's incredible.
Yes, and
yes.
then in 1975, I was traveling, visiting monasteries.
Yes.
And a friend of mine met me and said he wanted to go to Le Brie, and I didn't know what it was. But we went, and I stayed there and studied there, and then I became a Christian.
Yes. That's incredible.
And I became a Christian.
Yes.
I became a Christian because it became clear to me that it takes less faith to believe in Christianity than to believe in anything else. And that was one of the main reasons. And then I stayed there, and I worked for about 18 years in the community and traveled to other communities and came three times to South Africa
to give
some lectures and preach in townships and other kinds of activities. And then in 91, I came to Basel in Switzerland to be a pastor, which I did for 10 years. And then I began concentrating more on traveling and lecturing and preaching. And then I took another pastorate in Lausanne, which I'm doing now, as well as traveling. And I've written a little book about worldviews called Three Theories of Everything.
Yes.
And I'm just finishing a book about epistemology.
Oh, good. Well, I didn't know that, but this is our central theme today, is epistemology. So you are also exceedingly interested to know, how do we know that we know? How, as you so beautifully put, how far is far? Are the nearest stars far, or are they nearby? Is the Coma cluster of galaxies far? No, they're really close to home when we look to the Hubble Deep Field. Then we get, you know, so that question. But what's very interesting, tell me, in Zen Buddhism, are they specifically interested in these questions of relativeness and, for example, how high is up and so forth?
No.
Okay, so
they're interested in truth, but their conclusion is that truth is the self with a capital S, and that there is one self in reality, and it is Buddha nature. And so epistemology is expressed in experience in a rather existential way.
So,
although they're very intelligent people and they write lots of books, the foundational absolute is a total unity of self.
Now, what's very interesting is my wife, Liz, has a family member abroad. She may even be listening to us today. I do not know. But the interesting thing is that she'd enter a room. And for example, she'd say, "There's really very positive energy here. The energy, the I don't know the French word, but the energy here is you know, really remarkable." And then in this other room, the energy is not remarkable. So that's sort of a very central concept, is it not, Ellis, within Zen Buddhism?
It's not a central concept within Zen Buddhism, but it is within other forms of Buddhism and Hinduism.
Yes, yes. So what's very interesting in the scenario of our program, which is being fed out from global streaming via South Africa, is the fact that, you know, the importance of asking honest questions. Now, Thorsten, I'd like you to join in this conversation, please. And given the history and the current tumultuous history of our country, there are, you know, very few people in higher echelons or lower echelons who are really willing to be honest. I think it's one of the greatest problems we are facing in our country at the present time. How important is it to you, Thorsten, for people to actually ask questions which are honest and to actually accept answers which are honest?
I don't think we can understate the importance. I think one thing I'm noticing in our country, if we just contextualize it for South Africa, is that we haven't always been very good at asking questions or also at welcoming questions. And so I think we have, you know, various dynamics at play. It would be interesting to explore those. But, you know, we have the dynamic of a question being seen as disrespectful in some circles, or asking questions may be seen as doubting, and doubting is bad. And you need to just, you know, repeat the slogan often enough until you believe it. I also think there's a lot of fear at play, that we often just so scared of fielding a question, of receiving a question, because we might be unsure of the ground that we're standing on ourselves. So I think there's all sorts of dynamics that have made it, I think, difficult. Every year at the college at which I teach, I ask the students you know, which of you grew up in an environment, in a home, in a school in which questions were encouraged, and very few hands go up. I think it's changing, and it's changing for the better, and that is good. But it's important that it changes, because if I cannot have the freedom to ask the question, if I do not have the safe space to ask the question, then how do I grow? How do I learn? I also potentially cut myself off from meaningful relationship, because if I can't ask you an honest question, what does it say for our relationship? So I think it's absolutely critical that we're able to ask and receive good questions.
Of course, Thorsten, the interesting point here, and Ellis might to add on as well, is the following. Last night at a very large lecture I was giving at the University of Pretoria, I mentioned the fact that most of my students, in fact, are extremely afraid of silence. And I've asked people this really, you know, wherever I travel. In a week's time, I'll be in Sydney, as you know, Thorsten. But the important thing is that students are very scared of silence, and I've asked them why. Why is one addicted to, you know, having plugs in your ears with music 24/7, entering a mall, there's music, you know, going into an aircraft, there's music. There's a general great fear of silence. So I'd like you, Thorsten, to kick off and then Ellis to fill in. Now, with regard to silence, I think of the work, for example, Pensée by Blaise Pascal. And I'm writing a book about Blaise Pascal. But the interesting thing there is that Pascal thought in silence. He valued silence. Truth, to Pascal, emerged in a world of silence. He was very careful to say, the heart has its reasons that reason knows not of. And last night this resonated with everyone at the university whom I addressed, is that people are generally so scared of silence. I put up an image of Rodin's famous work, The Thinker, and I said to them, when last have you seen anyone like that seated in your lounge? And everybody in the audience said to me, Professor, I have never seen anyone seated like that in my lounge ever. Why do you believe, Thorsten, that people are so ultra afraid of really thinking through matters involving honesty?
Well, I think fear certainly is a factor, and but perhaps it can also just be that niggling background doubt. You know, is the way I'm building my life, are the decisions that I'm making, the priorities that I'm setting, are they actually solid? The other thing, though, I don't think it necessarily always needs to be fear. I think I see this with my kids. There are just so many distractions, and especially those that come on screens of various forms that vie for our attention. And so I think often it's also just a question of being, I don't know, just absorbed into the thing, into whatever looks for our attention the most. And if we are not thought through about what we invest our time and our thinking and our energy in, then we just get sucked into whatever is in our face the most.
Right, right. You know, Ellis, I'd love you to expand on this because, of course, you come from Switzerland, based in Switzerland now, and I think of the mountains, the hills, the Alps, but the silence. I just love walking in the snow in silence, pondering the great questions, the mysteries of the cosmos. Why do you believe people are so afraid to be silent and to just be still and think?
I think there's a difference between just being silent and thinking. I know the Swiss farmers are quite at peace with themselves and with their environment, and they're happy to be silent because they're at home with themselves. And when they're silent, they don't experience a great emptiness inside themselves. And I think that's one reason why people are afraid to be silent, because they're afraid to be alone with themselves. Because they don't know who they are, or when they look at themselves, they don't like what they see. And they realize that their thoughts are a chaos, or they only have other people's thoughts, and they don't have any thoughts of their own. And it's a bit disturbing. And so people are afraid of being confronted with reality without distraction.
And now, of course, If I think of my students at university, 250 of them, to whom I lecture every day, I think that one needs to then think of a remedy for this. You know, the addiction to technology. Technology, to all our listeners out there, I, as you know, a professor of applied math and computational applied math, am not decrying the use of technology. Please do not get me wrong. But I am saying that if technology is your master and not your slave, you are treading down a path where, as Ellis says, your thoughts are not your own. But now, the point is, to someone who is addicted in a very true sense to the SMS, to the iPod, to the iPhone, and all the other pieces of technology which students have, they simply won't break away from that. So we need to think of very clever ways of getting students to actually think out of the box. And I find this a challenge worldwide, really, whether I'm in South Africa or a guest investigator at Harvard University. I find people very scared to actually, the general student, age, say, 25 or 20, to actually sit and confront reality and who am I and do I have a purpose and is the universe accident or is it designed? What sort of remedy would you give to a student who can't break away from a continual 24/7 info input?
One little effort that I make is doing all of my teaching without electricity.
Expand, please.
I don't use any PowerPoint or recordings or amplification. There doesn't need to be any electricity in the room where I teach.
Mm-hmm.
I don't look at a screen ever.
Yes.
And my students don't look at a screen. They look at me, and I look at them, and we interact.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a technological silence for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very therapeutic for them.
Now, we have a little question here from Sam. Professor, I have come to the conclusion that there are some things in life that are absolutely unknowable, but many great thinkers just won't admit to that. Your response to Sam?
Well, I would need to know what sort of things that he's thinking about that are unknowable.
Yes.
Is he just imagining vaguely that some things are unknowable because that's some sort of excuse that he doesn't need to be responsible to the knowable things? Or does he have some specific things in mind?
He does. Sam is continuing here in his questions regarding origins of the universe. We think of Richard Dawkins and his view on the origins of the universe. I'll be happy to comment on that myself. He continues, God, is God knowable or unknowable? And good versus evil, are those not just relative rather than absolute definitions? Thorsten, with you, us here in studio, which one of the three would you like to pick? Origins of the universe, God, or good versus evil? And then we'll kick over back to Ellis in Switzerland.
David, it sounds like the first one of origins of the universe is very much your department.
Yes.
Do you want to kick us off on that?
Absolutely. So, in other words, many people would say, well, let me put it this way. And this is very clear in my book, a new book which is appearing, is that one of the greatest astronomers of all time was undoubtedly Galileo Galilei. And Galileo said he sees before him two books, the book of nature and the book of scripture. And he said there can be no contradiction because both have the same author. But he also said the Bible is not a scientific textbook, which is true. He said the Bible teaches us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. And I think that's one of the most crucial mistakes made in the 1600s was that the cardinals and pope of the time, Pope Urban VIII, I believe, really insisted that there was a geocentric universe, which, of course, we knew was utter nonsense, and that everything didn't revolve around the Earth. But the point is, with regard to origins, it's very, very interesting. I think one has to take this in two different sectors. One has to look at the book of nature. One has to look at the book of scripture and experience, you know, all forms of truth, I believe, are actually, in a sense, transcendent. In other words, as a believer, in the existence of God, who has entered both space and time, I am fully convinced that we, you know, I'm very happy to say that the work I do, Thorsten and Ellis, you know, at the university where I'm lecturing, say, on cosmic dust or whatever the themes might be, or the Big Bang itself, you can't a priori look at the universe and say, well, God definitely exists. There are great evidences towards it, the fine tunings of the weak nuclear force, the strong nuclear force, the electromagnetic force field, and the gravitational force field. But you can't a priori say that, you know, I can't just look up at the night sky and say, you know, God exists. But we are told in Scripture and by experience that when we look up at the night sky, we start thinking about these questions of the origins of the universe. But one has to be very careful in invoking a God, Ellis and Thorsten, who is continually retreating. That's been the theme of God for the last couple of centuries since Galileo, is that we call it the gods of the gap argument. In other words, we don't understand the origins of the universe, therefore God exists. Then we do start understanding the origins of the universe. For example, Stephen Hawking's work on gut, the grand unified field theories, and then, you know, God is no longer needed. So I believe that science, the book of science, like Galileo believed, the book of science and the book of nature are sharing different sectors of reality, of truth. Your thoughts, Ellis?
Well, in my book about epistemology that's coming out, I speak about four authoritative sources that inform our epistemology.
Yes.
And one is revelation.
Yes.
That content comes to us in the creation from outside of the creation.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't produced by the creation nor by us, but mm-hmm. it should fit the creation as mm-hmm. we experience it.
Mm-hmm.
And then another source is rationality,
mm-hmm.
that we can see how things work.
Mm-hmm.
And another source is what I would call tradition or institution or our cultural awareness. We
mm-hmm.
know things
mm-hmm.
in that way. And finally, there is personal experience
mm-hmm.
that each one of us has.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the origin of the universe,
yes.
as a Christian, I would say mm-hmm. the essential point is that reality is fundamentally not mechanical or energetic,
mm-hmm.
but personal and relational.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Could you expand on that?
That gives a mm-hmm. completely different context.
Mm-hmm. So, in other words, I believe that from a rational point of view, and this is wearing the hat of Professor David Block to our listeners today, but I would say that once one accepts a personal God, for example, then it becomes very easy to understand origins of the universe, notions of purpose, notion of mankind appearing down the line. You know, Einstein himself said the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's fully comprehensible. But I would add and caution that it's very interesting when you talk to people, for example, at Harvard, you can't simply, you know, they study the universe. And, you know, many of their responses might be, well, you know, God is just a myth. But I think one has to address the deeper issues, which Pascal addressed in the Pensée, in his great apologetic work, the Pensée, of origins, purpose, but also of the heart. Pascal was so in tune with people's hearts. Don't you think that's a critical aspect of epistemology and reality, Ellis?
It depends on what the heart means. If the heart means the center of us that includes the mind,
yes.
then I would be all for it.
Yes.
But if the heart means only the emotions
of
or
course.
The reactions
of
that
course.
We have,
mm-hmm.
then I would say, no, that's very limiting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we have to come to truth with our whole self in order to properly relate to it. We can't only relate to it with our mind or with our emotions or with our physical bodies and sensations. We have to bring our whole self, which I would say is the heart.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Your comments, Thorsten, now that you've had time to contemplate on the answers given by Ellis and myself. You don't necessarily need to tackle the origins of the universe, but you might like to tackle some of the other ones, like is God knowable or unknowable? Or the whole point we're really making, Thorsten, I suppose, is that to multitudes of our listeners who've read Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, is that they don't see any need for God whatsoever. And I think the key mistake there, Thorsten, is that they don't see any need for God. That is the, science has never, ever, or should never be invoked to prove the existence or the non-existence of God. He exists, as I point out in our book, Shrouds of the Night, outside of space and time. Your comments, Thorsten?
And following on from that, perhaps, okay, the need of God is, again, perhaps a slightly different question.
But, absolutely.
If God is the origin of all things, if he is God in any meaningful mm-hmm. sense of the word, mm-hmm. creator, then the very air that we breathe, we breathe because of God's existence. Mm. So we cannot actually then in that thinking then say we don't need God because we owe our every breath to him, if that would be true.
Right.
I just also wanted to say I do feel Sam's pain. I think let's be honest.
Yes.
It is difficult to connect with truth sometimes.
Yes.
But I think there's also I wouldn't give up the search. I would say that it's, even if one is not able to know fully, what if one is able to know truly?
Yes.
If you think of the relationship between any two people, we may not know each other fully, but we can still know each other truly. We can still stand in meaningful relationship with each other. Mm-hmm. And so the I loved Ellis's list of four ways of knowing.
Mm.
We can pursue, I mean, this is much more than we can chat about today, but we can pursue each one of those and find the fingerprints of God in each of them.
Listeners, you are hearing an incredibly interesting interview, I trust you agree. Ellis Potter in Switzerland, Thorsten Mirbach and Marbach in the studio, myself, David Block, the program Looking Up with David Block. Ellis, please stay on the line. We're going to have a music break, some real ethnic vibes from the tip of Southern Africa. You're listening to Professor David Block, Looking Up with David Block. To reach us in studio, 0861-555-189. The Twitter handle is at cliffcentral.com. On Instagram, if that is your social love, reach us on Cliff Central. On Facebook, likewise, just type in Cliff Central. And on WeChat, which is the most popular feed, also, Cliff Central. I will be away for 5 weeks, flying out to Sydney this coming week, and I will be interviewed each week by Gareth Cliff on his show, and there will be people standing in for me in my absence. But it's just such a joy to have such distinguished guests on the show today. Ellis Potter in Switzerland and Thorsten Mirbach in South Africa. Now, clearly, listeners, you can hear that Ellis really has a very warm way, very singularly warm way of answering questions without making one feel judgmental in any sense or angry towards oneself in any sense. He sort of, I love the word of labrie and shelter. You can hear from his voice. It's very calm, very relaxed, but the mind of someone truly great. So, Thorsten, I'd like to ask you, first of all, could you please tell us, I know I'm flying out and Ellis Potter is flying in, where can people go to see the schedule of Ellis Potter in South Africa?
David, we've got quite a few events lined up with Ellis. A lot of these events aren't sort of, you know, big stadium type events,
okay.
but a more small group, more interactive, more an opportunity
Good.
to interact with Ellis. Mm-hmm. Ellis will be out. He's flying out tomorrow. He will. Events will start on the Friday. Mm-hmm. Short of me listing all the events, I think the simple thing to do is just to give you the website reference.
Mm-hmm.
It will
do.
Be labrie.za.org. So on a website, you can do labrie without the apostrophe, labrie.za.org, and just make sure you get that the right way around. It's za.org, and that'll take you to a Facebook page that'll give you all the events that you can engage with Ellis with. This would be Cape Town, Stellenbosch,
awesome.
Johannesburg, mm-hmm. Pretoria, Tshwane. Mm-hmm. If you're in any of those places, do come along.
So for everyone who's following this live or going to follow it by podcast, Ellis Potter is flying out to South Africa tomorrow. And the webpage to look up his rather hectic schedule, I would say, as a speaker myself, it's a very busy schedule, but it's going to be just awesome, is labrie.za.org. So that's L for Larry, A for Apple, B for Billy, R for Robert, I.za.org. So, Ellis, to invite you back, please. I just watched a very short little clip before coming on the global screen today on your three theories of everything. Why don't you just gently walk us through what that book actually asserts?
Thank you, David. It talks about three absolute worldviews, and it's actually quite simple, as I think most great thinking is.
Mm-hmm.
It's as simple as 1, 2, 3.
Mm-hmm.
The first major worldview is monism, or oneism, the mm-hmm. belief that everything is one, mm-hmm. fundamentally,
mm-hmm.
and that diversity is an anomaly or evil,
mm-hmm.
and that to find true goodness, we need to immerse ourselves in the oneness of reality.
Mm-hmm.
The second worldview is dualism for two, and it's the idea that reality is made up of equal opposites,
mm-hmm.
and we suffer because the opposites are not in balance and harmony with
mm-hmm.
each other
mm-hmm.
as they are fundamentally.
Mm-hmm.
So the therapy for that is to have various practices to restore the balance of
mm-hmm.
reality.
Mm-hmm.
The third view is the biblical worldview,
mm-hmm.
which is three for the Trinity,
mm-hmm.
Father, Son, and Holy Spirit,
mm-hmm.
where the fundamental reality is personal and relational
mm-hmm.
and other-centered.
Mm-hmm.
So the center of the Son is not himself, it is the Father and the Holy Spirit,
mm-hmm.
and the same with the other persons.
Mm-hmm.
And we suffer in this worldview because we have become self-centered
mm-hmm.
rather than
mm-hmm.
other-centered. Centered.
Mm-hmm.
And so the therapy there is that God himself enters into the creation and becomes part of it, Merry Christmas, and then offers himself for the others
mm-hmm.
to remake the universe and reality as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And when we receive the power of that offering
mm-hmm.
of God himself,
mm-hmm.
then we can become new other-centered creatures
mm-hmm.
alive rather than dead self-centered creatures.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in other words, what you're saying is you're taking us through a walk of different scenarios, beginning with that really everything is just singular, everything is one, then rather a dualism, I would call it, of yin-yang, almost as Thorsten has also said. And then thirdly, a rather friendly universe where you actually encounter the awesomeness of God in such a real way. But now, for the listeners out there, how does one guide, in your mind, a person as to which of those scenarios is viable? Because let us just suppose that Richard Dawkins was sitting and listening to this global streaming today. What would you say to him, who wrote The God Delusion, what would you say to him who simply asserts that God is dead?
I would say that I don't want to be as religious as Richard Dawkins is.
Mm-hmm.
Because Richard Dawkins is having faith in an hypothesis yes. for which there is not a lot of basis.
Yes.
Whereas the hypothesis that I believe in has a lot of evidence mm-hmm. and a lot of basis mm-hmm. in the reality that I experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It takes less faith to believe in Christianity and the God of the Bible mm-hmm. than to believe in a machine mm-hmm. universe or an energetic mm-hmm. universe mm-hmm. or a totally chaotic mm-hmm. universe. There just isn't much evidence mm-hmm. for that kind of universe, given the reality of the human being.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say, on the whole, given the totality of the reality mm. in which we exist, mm. that Christianity is the least religious option mm. of a worldview.
Mm. Of course, what Dawkins would say, and I have watched him very closely on this, is that many people send him what's called Christian hate letters or Christian love letters, whatever you want to say. I think his program's called Christian Love Letters. And they really say, we're just going to thrive on watching you burn away because, you know, you're teaching us on, you know, key concepts of evolution and so forth. I like to look at a far grander sweep of the pen, Ellis, in that I like to look at the fundamental laws of the cosmos long before mankind ever emerged. Mm. I like to look at a global picture of the universe. Do you also like to do that?
Oh, yes. I ask people often, who was Jesus Christ before you were born?
Mm-hmm.
To get them to think out of their own box into a larger scope of reality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I want your answer. A beautiful, a thought has just appeared, a quote rather, has just appeared on the screen. And it's a quote by Jacques Fresco. And the response is that they'd like your response to the following quote. And it reads, and I quote, Jacques Fresco writes, and I quote, "Ignorant people invent gods and demons to understand the world around them. Science cures that," unquote. Your response, Ellis?
I think the first part is true, that ignorant people do invent a variety of gods and demons.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that that happens doesn't mean that there isn't a God who reveals himself.
Mm-hmm. And would you like to elaborate to someone? I mean, what would convince someone like Jacques? I mean, he's saying that ignorant people, you know, have invented God. Now we've got science. We don't need God anymore. What does Ellis Potter have to tell us or tell us that would be challenging enough to make us contemplate another worldview?
I think whatever I might say, it would be most important that I would offer him a cup of tea and give him loving hospitality and a true human caring relationship.
Interesting.
And pray that the Holy Spirit would touch his mind in ways that I will never be able to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the greatest leaders of all time certainly emerged from South Africa, as you know, former President Nelson Mandela. And I once tried to reach him. I had a number of occasions to meet him, Ellis, including one with Stephen Hawking. And on the one occasion, he was busy giving a party, and the party was for his gardeners, and he was giving them tea. And I just love what you say, because at the end of the day, I think that logic only takes you to a certain point, and I think Pascal was very strong about on this. It's interesting that you just sort of, you know, you've sort of take the trail or the rocket blazing, or the logical rocket blazing into space, and then bring it back to love, to relationship.
Yes.
That seems to be the way you address these questions head on. Am I correct?
Yes, I think it is essential. If the Bible is true, if we don't have love, we're just a silly noise.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, the point is, to our listeners who might be contemplating oneness or dualism or Trinity, what would you say to them? I mean, given that we can't offer everybody now listening to the global stream a cup of tea, what sort of key thoughts could Ellis Potter share with us regarding what choice do I make? I mean, a person might just say, well, I'm a Buddhist and, you know, I'm just happy to believe in reincarnation and so forth. And, you know, that is relative. And, you know, Ellis Potter believes in the Trinity and Richard Dawkins says, well, that's just trash. And he does say that. He uses very strong language against Christianity. What is your, I mean, apart from the cup of tea, which I think is absolutely beautiful, do you believe that logic will only answer certain key truths up to a point?
I think that logic has to be contextualized in other ways of knowing in order to function properly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, Jacques Fresco, it's interesting, he's appearing again on screen. He says, and please listen carefully, take off all the masks, manners, fancy clothes, all the devices you use, and be the most honest person you can be with yourself. Then whatever love you get is real, and the false approaches, like trying to be a player, only brings false results, unquote. What do you say to that?
I think he's in the right direction.
Yes.
Jesus was not a religious man.
Yes.
He was an ordinary man who
yes.
went about doing good and
yes.
meeting people.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's on the right track.
Mm-hmm. I think that Jesus did take off the masks. He did endeavor to take off the masks of people. He certainly never wore any fancy clothes, unlike some people whom we know. And I think he's, again, homing in, Jacques Fresco is, on the importance of being honest. But let's take someone sitting at their desk today, and they're just really seriously contemplating one of those three scenarios. What methodologies would you use to someone to say, look, I prefer viewpoint C rather than viewpoint A?
I would want to ask which of these worldviews answers the most questions.
Yes.
And in which of the worldview do I belong as a question asker?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in the first worldview, if I would ask who is asking these questions,
yes,
the answer would be asking is.
Yes. Yes.
But in the third worldview, the answer would be I am asking.
Mm-hmm.
And the validity of me having a point of view mm-hmm. and asking a question mm-hmm. is established and maintained
mm-hmm.
by God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then that seems to be the least religious solution
mm-hmm.
to the question.
Mm-hmm. I think that it's very important. I think that, you know, having walked this path for more than 30 years, it's just very clear to me that you've got different domains to our being, and logic can only answer, for example, the central truths, you know, of, say, general relativity or special relativity. But, you know, for example, love cannot be quantified. I can't give you an equation to describe love. And I think that, you know, in the Gospels, for example, it's so epitomized, the love, the logos, the love. And I think that's really your central theme in your third alternative for the theory of everything, is it not?
Yes, it is, because one of the most important things in human life is marriage. And no matter how brilliant you are as a logical person, you cannot have an accurate marriage.
Yes, that's right.
The variables are
that's
just
right.
too many.
Mm-hmm.
Logic will not contain or explain or guide you in marriage. There has to be other ways of knowing that fit in.
Mm-hmm. 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 Now, Ellis, Carl Sagan has said something interesting which appeared on the screen now. The universe is much bigger than our prophet said, much grander, more subtle, more elegant. My God is a little God, says Carl Sagan, and I want him to stay that way, quote unquote. Thorsten, your comments briefly. I know I'm throwing this as a curveball, but would you like to? Okay, Ellis, you kick off with this one. My God is a little God, and I want him to stay that way, says Carl Sagan. Your comment.
Well, I think that's the attitude of a lot of insecure people. that we want to be bigger than we actually are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if his God is a little God, then he's a totally useless and ridiculous God, just
yes.
some sort of a plaything that you
yes.
keep on the shelf and
yes.
bring down from time to time.
Yes.
I think if you want to have any kind of God at all, you have to have an absolutely big one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, folk, you're listening to Ellis Potter being interviewed live on this global streaming. To follow him on his visits to our precious country, you simply type labri.za.org or just watch my Twitter feed at Starry Galaxy Man, and I'll certainly be advertising all of Ellis Potter's talks. But Thorsten, why don't you interject here?
The reason I was stalling was I was looking for a particular quote from C.S. Lewis, mm-hmm. which I think plays into that mm-hmm. into that space very well. I think mm-hmm. if it's risky to embrace a large God,
mm-hmm.
and it's risky to mm-hmm. embrace a personal God. Mm-hmm. I do make myself vulnerable when that happens.
Mm-hmm.
The C.S. Lewis quote mm-hmm. talks about an impersonal God versus a personal one.
Mm-hmm.
Here it is. An impersonal God, well and good.
Mm-hmm.
A subjective God of beauty, truth and goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Inside our own heads, better
mm-hmm.
still.
Mm-hmm.
A formless life force surging through us, a vast power which we can tap,
mm-hmm.
best of all.
Mm-hmm.
But God himself, alive,
mm-hmm.
pulling at the other end of the cord,
mm-hmm.
perhaps approaching at an infinite speed.
Mm-hmm.
The hunter, king, husband.
Mm.
That is quite another matter.
Mm. We have that's very interesting. And, you know, as we're wrapping up in the last 4 minutes of this hour's broadcast, Christopher Wheeler, very hearty welcome to you. And you've got a great little thought here. And I'd love both of you to respond. Ellis first. He says here, Christopher Wheeler, and a very warm welcome to you. The religiosity driving South Africa's cultural and politics is corrosive and blunts critical thinking before it starts. Ellis, you take the ball.
Yes, I would agree with that. I'm not a religious person. I used to be a religious person, but now I am a Christian.
Yes, yes.
And I think religion, in the sense of a system
yes.
that approaches absolute
yes.
reality,
yes.
is, as Karl Marx said, most often the opiate of the people
yep.
and
yep.
a means of manipulating people.
Yep.
But Christianity is not a religion.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
It is simply the truth of reality.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that religion is God's greatest enemy? Because I often say that.
I would have to think about that, but I might move in that direction.
Yes. I just think of Galileo Galilei facing the church and religiosity, hardcore thinking, and that certainly blunted critical thinking, and it was religiosity. You think of Tyndale, burnt at the stake for wanting to give England the Bible in English. That was simply blunting critical thinking, and that was the church doing the job.
Yes. And I would like to say to our first person who contacted us.
Yes, to Sam.
I hope, pardon me?
To Sam.
To Sam. I would like to say, Sam, I hope that you will always remain a skeptic. Because a skeptic is someone who is not convinced that they know everything
mm-hmm.
and believes that they need to learn more.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't remain a skeptic, you will either become a cynic that believes you know that everything is nonsense,
mm-hmm.
or you will become a fanatic whose mind is closed.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. That's beautiful. Ellis, that is just awesome. 1 minute for Thorsten's response there.
Okay. I would want to unpack a little bit with what Christopher means with religiosity.
Yes.
So I would want to unpack that and ask,
yes.
Are we talking about beliefs that are aligned with reality, with
mm-hmm.
the way things really
mm-hmm.
are,
mm-hmm.
or are we talking about beliefs that are running counter to that? So,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't use the word religiosity in that context.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, do we believe mm-hmm. things that are true? Do we
mm-hmm.
believe And are those beliefs helping us forward? This is, of course, a very loaded question. And perhaps we shouldn't be drawn on into a political discussion 30 seconds before the show ends.
Well, I can't wait. Unfortunately, I will not be able to attend Ellis's talks, but I certainly hope, maybe, Thorsten, that we can squeeze in a cup of tea with Ellis before I fly to Sydney on Sunday. But Ellis, it's been a singular joy. Really, I can just sense across the lines warmth, honesty, the great joy of pursuit like Blaise Pascal did. Thank you for joining us, Thorsten. Thank you too for joining us. Ellis, the South African soil cannot await your presence
with greater anticipation. To Liz.
I will tell her. Thank you and God bless
you. Thank you, David.
God bless you too. Thank you.